Another home builder barometer looks better this month.
But is that enough to fire up the housing market?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hi, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org, and it's Tuesday, September 21st. The Fed meets today to talk policy and what's next. GM looks to China to sell some shares. And in New York, you can order a grilled cheese by phone. You know, your friend's got the number. But first,
we learned from the government this morning, housing starts rose more than expected last month. Now, why would anybody be building new homes right now? Let's get some perspective now from Julie Niemann, analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Hi, Julie.
Morning, Bill.
As I said, housing starts rose 10% in August. Now, Julie, faithful listeners have heard you warn us about all the foreclosed and repossessed properties just waiting to flood an already depressed market. So tell me, why would home builders be breaking ground now?
Well, here's my cold water on all of this. Okay. This figure is only better than last August, and that was the all-time historic low. So we're looking also at the time of the year when you do seasonal adjustments. So they're ramping it up by about 10%. It's actually probably flat, if we're lucky. But the composition is the big thing. Most of this is in alternative housing, which are apartments, not new housing.
I saw that. What does the rise of apartment building tell us?
Well, for 20 years, the American dream has been everybody owns their own home, and it became really at your own price, at whatever price it would clear. Now it's fear and loathing, and people basically don't want to own real estate, period. They're going for alternative housing, moving into apartments. There's still demand. The kids have to move out of the house at some point in time, and everybody's looking for apartments. That's the big spur to development right now.
Fear and loathing of the big house.
And it's all regional, too. So we're looking at the sand states are still in the tank. The Northeast is. Some cities are still completely in the dumper. Where you're seeing it really hold up well is probably in the manufacturing index. But really, the builder's confidence index is still declining. New permits for family housing fell. So nationwide, you're looking at this used housing inventory still huge. It's about 12 and a half months that has to be worked off. And we've got a whole basket full of foreclosures for the banks. They're holding it back at this point.
Yes.
So this is statistical noise.
We're warned again. Thanks for the cold water, Julie Niemann.
You bet.
Today, the Federal Reserve meets to discuss the economy and interest rates. The central bank will look at whether there's anything left to be done to kickstart a very, very slow recovery. David Weiss is chief economist at S&P. He's with us from New York. Good morning, David.
Hi, good morning.
All right. What's the Fed looking at as it pertains to policy decisions they may make? What are some of the numbers that they're looking at?
Well, the last 6 weeks, the numbers have been coming in a little bit better. It looks definitely like there's a recovery going on. It's just a very slow recovery. Housing starts this morning. We're just the latest example of numbers coming in a bit better than expectations.
And we'll talk about that in just a minute. What are the Fed's options, David? They can't take interest rates much lower. What else can they do?
And you can't lower interest rates below zero. Their option is quantitative easing, which means lowering other interest rates rather than just short-term by buying long-term government bonds, mortgage-backed paper, corporate bonds, and anything else they can find.
I want to ask you about this report that came out yesterday saying the recession ended in June of 2009. Is that a testament, do you think, to Fed policy of the past, or maybe just a bit of luck?
Well, probably some of both. It's mostly natural timing of the cycle. Eventually, recessions end because people have to start spending money again. Timing's about right. It always takes the NBER about a year to determine that the recession's over.
All right. David Weiss talking to us from S&P. David, thanks.
Thank you.
The International Air Transport Association, the IATA as we know it, says global airlines have rebounded faster than expected from the recession. The group raised its profit forecast for this year. Steve Lott is head of communications for the North America IATA, and he's with us now live from Washington. Welcome to the program, sir.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
All right. Why all this optimism from the IATA?
Absolutely. Well, the industry is climbing out of a deep, deep hole. Over the past decade, the industry's lost about $50 billion. So there's been lots of red ink, but really the improved outlook is driven by several factors. One, on the revenue side, increasing demand from passengers is growing, the planes are full, and we're seeing revenues climb higher. At the same time, costs have remained relatively stable. Fuel prices have generally remained about $75, $80 a barrel, and that stability has helped the industry.
We've seen a lot of airlines merging, though, Steve. United, Continental, of course, just last week, Delta, Northwest. What role do these mergers play in the positive forecast you guys have?
Sure. Well, as we've seen some of these mergers and acquisitions, it's led to some capacity constraint. As airlines have combined, they've kept a careful watch on capacity and kept a tight lid on that capacity expansion. So in some cases, we've actually seen the amount of capacity or seats available drop a bit. So that's actually a good thing for an airline's bottom line as demand increases.
And we used to see that, right? When airlines, when things are really good, they tend to grow and they add flights and routes and all that. But that's not happening.
Exactly right. And in the past, we've actually seen airlines been too quick to add capacity and flights back. They've jumped the gun a bit. But the good news is this time around, and one of the reasons for a more optimistic forecast, is that airlines, especially in the U.S., have been very slow to add capacity back, which, again, is a good thing, and that actually helps the bottom line.
Steve Lott, head of communications for the North America IATA. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Ireland today passed a crucial economic test. The government had a bond sale, and it ended up raising $2 billion from optimistic investors. Here's the BBC's John Bithrie.
Ireland is trying to avoid a Greek-style debt crisis after bailing out its banks and just about surviving a property crash. So analysts are relieved at the success of the bond auction after growing concern that the IMF may need to step in. Austin Hughes is chief economist at KBC Ireland.
I think it's understandable that investors are unconvinced because of concerns about the general growth outlook and because of the escalating costs of the bank bailout.
And this uncertainty means lenders were willing to make loans, but at a higher interest rate. Meantime, the pressure on the government to get things right is intensifying. The Irish leader, Brian Cowan, had to apologise for an embarrassing early morning radio interview.
What I've been emphasising, what we've all been emphasising, is the strengths of our economy. What's the base upon which we can grow and recover?
Critics accused him of being somewhere between drunk and hungover. But while the Prime Minister admits it wasn't his best interview, he blames the gravelly voice and slurred words on a late night. In London, I'm the BBC's John Bithrie for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, September 21st. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out our website, marketplace.org, and right there you can find the numbers. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects the United States. After going bankrupt and getting bailed out by the U.S. government, GM may now sell a stake of its company to China's largest state-owned automaker, SAIC. The company's reportedly expressed an interest in buying GM shares for the company's IPO later this fall. Now, the Chinese owning a portion of an American icon may rattle a few people, but as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, it's a more natural partnership than you might think.
GM sells more cars in China than in the U.S., thanks to its 13-year-old joint venture with SAIC. That's why you see more Buicks than Toyotas on Chinese roads. So SAIC wanting to own a share of GM is hardly shocking.
From an industry perspective, it makes a whole lot of sense.
That's IHS auto industry analyst Paul Newton. He says the two companies are already developing energy-efficient engines together, and GM has moved almost all its advanced technology development to new Chinese R&D labs.
So, you know, from a perspective of, you know, who owns them, then you know, why a financial institution when you can have someone who has a complete and utter vested interest in your success?
The relationship between GM and China is so cozy that the two are working on a communist propaganda film together, coming to a theater not so near you, Birth of a Party, a celebration of the 90th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. The film's official sponsor, Cadillac. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The United Nations has had a goal for nearly a decade to, among other things, help cut extreme poverty, part of its so-called Millennium Development Goals. And a recent report shows there has been some success. This week, world leaders will get an update on many of the goals as they meet in New York. They are hoping the global economic downturn hasn't derailed what they had set out to do. From Johannesburg, reporter Gretchen Wilson has more.
In one corner of this inner-city park, there are rows of raised garden beds. Mabule Mokine points to leafy green vegetables.
Of chard, spinach, and I see now, because it's spring, there is strawberry. That is strawberry.
Mokine is with the Greenhouse Project, a nonprofit that teaches city dwellers how to grow food on their balconies and rooftops. Not because it's cool, because they're hungry.
the incidence of HIV and AIDS. It has left a number of households being run by children, you know.
The first Millennium Development Goal is to cut in half the number of people in extreme hunger and poverty by 2015. At this rate, most countries in Southern Africa aren't going to make it. José Koch is with the Regional Hunger and Vulnerability Program.
The commitment and the effort is there. It's just that the problem is so huge.
Still, countries around the world have made headway on the goals to provide basic education for all boys and girls alike, to curb the spread of HIV/AIDS, and to reduce child and maternal mortality rates. The summit buzz is about the billions of dollars needed to go further. But in the wake of the global financial crisis, the question is, who's going to pay for it?
The only way forwards is to really make sure that trade does get more equal.
Many in Southern Africa say they don't want charity as much as they want investment, access to markets, and loans for their small businesses. This kind of economic development doesn't depend on donations, which can be squandered by dishonest governments. And though the UN doesn't have a big stick to force governments to meet the goals, citizens do. Nokutula Magudulela is with Amnesty International.
People can march, they can write petitions, they can litigate. People need to raise their voices at their local level.
That kind of leverage will be crucial in the next 5 years. As countries strive to achieve the Millennium Development Goals, the biggest coordinated effort in human history to reduce extreme poverty. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
The global cost of caring for people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia is likely to reach $600 billion this year. And the World Alzheimer's Report criticizes countries such as the United States for not spending enough on research into the disease. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
We've heard a whole lot about the human costs of dementia. Now we're getting a sense of the economic costs. What are the projections for the future?
Well, the report reckons the number of people with dementia will triple by the middle of the century to a total of 115 million. This is clearly going to have a major impact on total cost of care, especially in the US, which spends most on care for dementia patients at the moment, a total of $172 billion a year for the US as a whole.
Now, you're talking about care, but why is the US being criticized for its spending on research?
Well, the report points out that the National Institutes of Health in the U.S. spend between $400 and $500 million a year on Alzheimer's research. Compare that with $5 or $6 billion on cancer. Anders Vimo, who was involved in the report, says they hope to persuade governments to redress this imbalance by drawing attention to the financial burden of dementia care.
When we have put figures on the cost, I think that will improve the possibilities for nations and governments to really focus on dementia as some kind of national problem in the future.
He points out that unlike some developed countries, the U.S. does not have a national plan for dealing with dementia.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, September 21st. I'm Bill Radke, and for the latest look at the markets, just go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Today in Washington, the Transportation Department is hosting a conference on the danger of distracted driving. Marketplace's Elisa Roth is here live to talk about it. Good morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
So tell us about distracted driving and the pressure the government is under to curb it.
16% of all highway deaths are related to distracted driving. And as you referred to, that's not just talking on your phone, but it's writing texts, it's using your GPS, it's searching your MP3 player. The other thing is that number is probably low because not all states ask about distracted driving on accident reports. Lawmakers at both the state and federal levels have been trying to enact more rules that would forbid distracted driving, again, broadly defined. Texting and driving specifically is illegal in 30 states plus Washington, D.C. It's also banned for commercial truck drivers and bus drivers in a lot of states.
And I would think technology, it sounds like a problem, but couldn't it have a fix, Elisa? What's being done on the technology side of this?
There are a lot of things that are being done. Companies are looking at ways to make those activities safer. So voice recognition software that lets you create a text message without using your hands or make a phone call without dialing. Car companies are also looking at ways to integrate these technologies linked to the dashboard, so there's less maneuvering around with small devices. One of the big challenges for the lawmakers these days is to write the new laws so they're broad enough to cover technologies that we may not have thought of yet. And that's probably one of the things that they'll be talking about at this summit today.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth, thank you.
You're welcome.
The federal government's budget year ends in about a week and a half, but Congress is nowhere near passing a new budget. Well, Marketplace's Janet Babin reports, if at first you don't meet the deadline, push it back.
Lawmakers like to say yes, but each year around budget time, they become Dr. No's. They have to turn down requests for money, or the deficit keeps ballooning. That's one reason why federal budgets are often late, especially in contentious election years. Now some in Congress want to take a page from state legislatures and only pass a budget every 2 years.
The only thing a biennial budget will cut is the number of politically painful votes members of Congress have to take.
That's Stan Collender with Corbis Communications. He worked for both the House and Senate budget committees for years. Fans of a biennial budget say the break would give Congress more time to hammer out a budget blueprint. But Collender says that blueprint would be wrapping paper just as soon as it's published.
We're in a world where news is reported instantly, and it requires Congress not to wait 2 years before they respond with a budget.
About 20 states still use a biennial process, but many others have ripped up that rulebook in favor of a yearly budget. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
As I'm sure you've only seen in movies, when someone wants illegal drugs, they call an anonymous dealer who shows up with the goods. Well, an entrepreneur who goes by the name of Ronnie is trying this technique with grilled cheese sandwiches. So hungry customers get Ronnie's number from a friend. They text their order, and within 15 minutes, they receive a hot grilled cheese anywhere on New York's Lower East Side. Our friend Brendan Francis Noonan, co-host of the Dinner Party Download, gave this a try.
Okay, I'm here on location in the Lower East Side. I just texted this number, and I just told him where I was. So it's been about 10 minutes, and now every time I look around, I think I see Ronnie. Is Ronnie a kid with alabaster legs that look like lollipop sticks riding a skateboard? Is Ronnie riding a bike with a cast on one leg?
Hey, how's it going?
You're Ronnie? Yeah, do you have the stuff?
I do. I have the stuff right here for you.
We didn't even talk about price.
Price? This is a $5 sandwich.
You have change for 10?
What kind of dealer would I be without change?
Look at all that. How many grilled cheese have you moved today?
Today, done like 50.
Do you mind sitting while before I snack on this? So, how did this get started?
Basically, I was making a grilled cheese for all my buddies when we'd come back after a night out, and they loved it and told their friends, and their friends kind of spread the word, and it grew bigger just by word of mouth.
And so then how did that turn into, like, people texting you randomly and press about this?
So the press happened because my brother's girlfriend used to be in PR, and she contacted Urban Daddy, and they ate it up.
Literally?
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna check this out. It's really nice bread. Yep. Hey, what kind of bread is this?
What do I have? Rye there from Blue Ribbon Bakery.
And we have Granny Smith apples and gooey cheddar cheese.
And a whole lot of cheddar cheese.
Excellent. And it's still hot. Yeah. Your kitchen must be, I know you're not going to tell me, but your kitchen must be pretty close.
It's pretty close. And I did a couple laps around the block trying to find you.
So what's next?
Next, I'm looking to get into a legal kitchen. For example, a restaurant that isn't open for lunch. I would rent it out from them and just work the lunch shift, delivering sandwiches everywhere.
You know how people are really picky in restaurants? Has anyone, like, sent you back?
I've gotten nothing but good feedback.
Isn't that part of it, though? Because you get away with a lot because it's such a clever setup that this sandwich could suck and I would still be tickled.
Definitely. The product still has to be good, but even if it's not excellent, people are still probably going to like it.
So when are you going to be able to reveal your identity?
Once I get into a legal kitchen.
So why Ronnie?
Well, it's the perfect pseudonym because it's my name also.
Brendan Francis Noonan is co-host of our sister show, The Dinner Party Download, and you can subscribe to that podcast by visiting dinnerpartydownload.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.